Good morning, if it is morning. This is Sven Gulli, and you're listening to Too Much Scrolling.
Good morning! Welcome to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours, episode 132 for October 6th, 2020. I'm Steve Fuller.
And I'm Chip Hassenfleur, dressed as Robert Smith from The Cure.
And I'm just plain old Pam the Door.
Who doesn't say blah, blah, blah.
Why aren't you guys dressed up? I thought we were going gothic today.
Chip, I'm Hungarian. This is a story about my life. I'm always dressed this way. Have you ever noticed that
English
I always
professor.
Wear black?
I teach this course. I teach this novel regularly.
So you've got your robes on and your sashes and your mortarboard. Robe. Is it a mortarboard day for you?
At the end, we'll pass over the little thing hanging off, the tassel hanging off.
I have my Yukon hoodie. I'm ready.
There you go. So, Pam, we need to start with you because this is your pick. You brought this book to us in the book club.
Yes. And you guys, this is one of my all-time favorite books to teach. I love reading this book, but wow, do I love bringing it to students. Now, most of my students are traditional age students, 18 to 24, and usually no one has read the book, but everybody knows about Dracula. So you ask people, what do you know about Dracula? People think they know quite a lot, right? They know Dracula's a vampire. He has kind of that like sort of fake accent that you were doing so nicely, Chip. Awesome job. And people know that Dracula's this really scary vampire. He's from the 19th century. And then it gets a little fuzzy about exactly what Dracula is or represents. So I'm like, okay, go read the book. Now, this is a long book, and students are never like, awesome, a 400-page book. That's what I'd like to read. Oh, written in Victorian English. Fantastic. But you guys, students love this book, and students get scared while reading this book. That's one of my favorite things about it. I remember one time, at a group a few years ago, and I had this heavily tattooed young man who read the novel on his way on the train to New York. And later on, there's a lot of train scenes. And he told us, like, I got so scared of this book. I've never felt this much fear from a book. Movies can scare me, but a book, really? And the fact that 120 years later, this book can still like chill you a little bit. To me, it really speaks to the power of literature. Like the fact that you can put a bunch of words on a page and those words are arbitrary symbols above, it works. Like literature impacts people. And that's what I love about this book.
And back to that cultural icon idea, everybody knows Dracula, Pam.
Yeah.
I don't know what you're talking about that you teach this book and people don't know this book. Everybody knows Dracula.
Sparkly Dracula.
Oh, jeez.
Sparkly Dracula.
There's no sparkly vampires.
With lots of paprika.
Okay, lots of paprika I'll take, but the sparkly vampire genre is not my favorite genre. But you're right, Pam. People don't know this writing. This is so much central to the entire idea of the vampire, even though this is not the first vampire story.
Right. And in fact, John Polidori is often credited with writing the first English language vampire story. There are lots of vampire stories in other languages.
And he wrote that on that night when Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, that night in the dark, in that so wonderful story about the creation of Frankenstein, the creation of the vampire was in there too.
Well, and that's one of the questions that I want us to think about over the next 4 weeks as we delve into this book is like, what is the meaning of the vampire? Why does the vampire remain quite popular 200 years after it became this sort of way to think about a lot of issues in English and now American culture? And so this is a question that is, again, we won't answer, but I want to think about it. The vampire kind of taps into a lot of really important cultural anxieties.
I'd like to thank Arthur Conan Doyle for setting me up to read this so well, because after reading all those stories, I feel like I'm totally ready to read it. And it just, I didn't have to struggle with the wording. I didn't have to struggle with the pacing. I was just right there. So
We are certainly focused in Sandwiches at Irregular Hours on this era, aren't we? We certainly have Pam, who is the expert in this late Victorian era, and she's brought to us all these different stories that we've really enjoyed, and they're really focused on that timeline, aren't they?
They are, but I think one of the things that makes them so amazing is they're also so relevant to today. But let's think through the Victorian timeline just a little bit. And one of the things that often surprises my students is that Frankenstein and Dracula are written like 80 years apart. And so students often think that they might have come out at the same time, but Frankenstein actually came out in 1819 and Dracula 1897, so a full 80 years later. Just to contextualize that, Frankenstein's so much earlier, 60 years earlier than anything else we've been talking about. Studying Scarlet, the first Sherlock Holmes, comes out in 87. Jack the Ripper Murders, relevant to Dracula, serial killer, 88. Chicago World's Columbian Exposition, 1893.
With another serial killer, H.H. Holmes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oscar Wilde Sent to Prison, 1895. We'll be talking about sexuality a lot in a later episode. Dracula, 1897, and then The Hound of the Baskervilles, which kind of brings together all the gothic themes that we'll be talking about here, 1902. So this is a really, really, really rich period, the late 1880s and 1890s in Victorian literature. Really one of my very favorite periods, as you guys know.
Really? You've never mentioned.
We should do a book club where we read stories from
Strictly.
That area.
Strictly from that era. We're never going to read anything else in this book club ever.
We're moving out of the area.
So the format of this one is so much, it's really different from everything that we've read up to this point, right?
Well, and this is called the epistolary format. And so epistolary are, well, you know, in the Bible, the epistles are letters, right? So the epistles of Paul to the Corinthians, etc. So, epistolary format was very popular in Victorian fiction, and we haven't read them. That's not something that Conan Doyle used, but it was pretty popular form of writing, and it brings together a series of documents. So some epistolary novels, like the very famous Pamela, which I'm not named after, but is just letters. Person A writes to person B, writes to person A, writes to person B. But many of them are like Dracula. You've got several people's journals. You've got phonograph notes that are then copied over from John Seward's, recordings of his observations. You've got newspaper clippings, letters from characters, train schedules, etc. So did you guys like this or dislike it? Because I think that we don't have the epistolary form isn't so alive in 2020. I mean, you get a few novels here and there. Bridget Jones's Diary is a very famous one, from the 21st century. Well, did you guys like the format or not? What did it do for you as a reader to just have this set of documents?
I think it's really flexible and allows the writer to change the voice of the narrator. We don't establish in the exposition here who the narrator is because we're getting this viewpoint, these very, very different perspectives from these three very different stories all at the same time. And we, the reader, are thrown into the middle of it because we are experiencing it through the voices of these different characters.
And we don't have an all-seeing God giving us a story where all information is presented to us. We only have the information as it's experienced through our journal entries or our diary entries or our letters or however that's being presented. So it allows us to miss details that would give away what's really going on.
And I wonder about, is this presented as someone has collected this material together, like some sort of dossier on the happenings of this time? How did Jonathan Harker get mixed up into this? How did Mina and Lucy get into this whole situation? That would be very interesting if there was a narrator, a detective of some sort, who was uncovering the truth of Dracula.
Well, Queen Victoria, I don't think had anything to do with this, Steve.
I don't know. I don't know. The Masons are very, oh boy.
And we are going to have some interesting doctor figures in this novel, for sure. Now, and one thing that I think the epistolary allows Stoker to do is really create these very separate narrative strands that are all going to come together eventually. But right now, in these first six chapters, we've got three or four chapters coming out of Harker's journal. So that's one story, the Harker Dracula story in Transylvania. Then we have the Lucy Mina story in London. And then we also have just the beginning of the Jonathan Seward Renfield story. And these, they have like connections, but they seem fairly different kinds of stories. And so eventually we're going to see Stoker pull them all together. But that epistolary format allows him to keep them all pretty well paced and energetic, even though he's flipping you from one thing to another.
And I love that style of storytelling. Anytime an author can bring together the different strands and at the end it all comes together and makes sense. I think that's what I love about the Marvel Cinematic Universe. All those little stories that were really good little stories, and then they come together into this massive, amazing storytelling where they all made sense. That you needed to know all of those little details from all of those little stories in order to get to the climax.
If only the Universal Monsters could come together in their own universe, Steve.
They tried so hard, and they failed so badly at doing that. But you do bring up the Universal Monsters. I do want to talk about that for a second. In the 1930s, we saw all of these stories made into movies at the birth of the monster movie genre. We see Dracula, Frankenstein, the Wolfman, the Invisible Man, the Creature from the Black Lagoon, all of those icons of horror films that I love watching those movies over and over again. They are very different stories from the originals. Like a Disney kind of rewriting of them that happens in those movies. So people who know, quote unquote, know Dracula might be very surprised if they read the original.
But I think that's part of the pleasure, right? And this novel, like, I think this is what I like so much about this novel. It stands up to the scrutiny of young people in the 21st century who think they know Dracula, and they enjoy this novel so much. So it's not like the Disneyfication or the horror movie version of Dracula, because there have been many different versions. Neither one of those is strong enough to supplant the original. Like, that's what I like about it. That's what really, to me, makes this a really, just a powerful example of how literature can work. Can I ask you guys, so of the three narrative strands that have started so far, which one like had you the most interested? Is it the Harker of Dracula? Is it the Lucy Mina? Or is it the Renfield Seward?
Oh, it's Harker. Harker, absolutely.
Okay, tell us why.
Why? Because you get thrown into, it's mysterious. You're going to a faraway area. It's certainly like the untamed earth. You're going through a community that's basically warning you about what's going to happen. You get the spooky exposition as you're going towards the castle through the forest. You only see one person. And then the whole setup during this time until, you know, he finds out that he is the prisoner. It's just the setup. It's just perfect. You know, he's hopeful. He's got a job to do. And then all of a sudden he recognizes, oh my goodness, this is not what I signed up for.
I see where you're going with that, that this is the central plot of the story, is who is Dracula and how is Dracula affecting this particular character in Harker. But I think my favorite is the Mina and Lucy, because they have a real bond, a real interesting conversation is being had between those two. I am very interested in seeing how that plays into the central characters of Dracula and Harker.
And I think that Renfield is just so like creepy and disturbing that no one's going to be like, it's my favorite, but we know that it's super important. So let's go through these one by one, right? So with the Dracula Harker scene, Chip, I'm so glad you bring up like awesome pacing, right? So we have young Jonathan Harker. He's a brand new lawyer, and he's been given his first big job. He's about to get married. He's pretty excited. He's a young man on a mission. It's his first business trip, right? And so he goes off, and I love the scene where he runs into these, like, peasants, and the woman's like, oh, you're going to Dracula's castle? Here, take this crucifix. He's like, oh, no thanks. He's, like, not very superstitious. And she's like, no, take it. And so it's like, and of course, I think that reading it in 2020, like, hello, we know you don't want to go to Dracula's castle. We might not know all the details, but, you know, young Jonathan, this is not good news. And so it's got, like, just this wonderful energy that kind of makes us as 21st century readers, like, you feel a little bit like, oh, we know what's going on. But then you get pretty spooked, right? Did you guys get spooked? It's pretty awesome.
The atmosphere, the surroundings. I mean, everything just seems like there's something going wrong. And Jonathan's not, he's aware of it, but he's not taking action on it because, you know, he is a person from civilized world, and this is how, you know, we take on the quote-unquote uncivilized.
And his naivete, because he is a 20-something. He is a young kid who's got this job. He sees the danger, but he, like you said, he doesn't do anything about it. He is in mortal danger, and we see it in his writing. He is writing this letter saying, I don't know what's going to happen. Dracula's asking me to write these letters for weeks and weeks from now to send to my fiance. That seems bad. Okay, I'll do it.
He feels so hopeless, right? And I mean, I think there's a moment that I had kind of forgotten this quotation where he even says, I asked Dracula when I'd be allowed to leave. And he says, now I know when my life will end. It's pretty dark. Now, I really like the use of the wolves. And Stoker actually brings up werewolves as well as vampires. And of course, in monster literature of the 21st century, we like werewolves, vampires, and zombies for all three very, very different reasons. But I just love this quotation where Dracula tells Harker about the wolves. This is very, very early on. He says, listen to them, the children of the night, what music they make. Seeing, I suppose, some expression in my face strange to him, he added, ah, sir, you dwellers in the city cannot enter into the feelings of the hunter. So we get some of these themes kind of played out here, right? Jonathan's a young city boy. He's soft, right? He has this sort of, you know, professional white collar masculinity as he's heading off into a less civilized place. And he can't hear the music of the wolves. So he has lost touch with nature, with predators, right? Mm-hmm. Dracula, he's in communion with the predators of his setting. And that's a pretty terrifying thought.
And Pam totally missed the opportunity to use an accent. The children of the night.
Oh, dear.
Listen to them.
You're never going to get me to take that opportunity, my friend.
Listen to them, the children of the night. Oh, what music they make. Ah, sir, you dwellers in the city cannot enter into the feelings of the hunter.
And tell me more about London.
Blah, blah, blah.
Okay, so clearly I shouldn't be reading the Dracula quotes. Someone can actually do them justice.
That's my original foreign language. I learned Hungarian as my first foreign language. I learned English first, and then my grandparents from Hungary taught me enough words to get by in at the dinner table. Servus, hojvaj, egeshegeda. Egeshegeda was big in the household. Egeshegeda means just a little. When my grandmother was offering dessert, and my grandfather would say, "Ah." Egeshegeda, only a little bit. He wanted more dessert.
Now, did you guys notice how clearly Jonathan Harker, at the beginning, he's describing every meal with, like, gourmet detail? Mm-hmm. He's loving the food of Transylvania.
It's a travel journal there, right?
Yeah.
This is what we do when we travel, is we describe this new place and this new food. And yes, Bram Stoker's done that very well here.
And the idea that he may not experience that again. So he's journaling it for posterity, for his memories. He's setting himself up for it later on.
And for Mina, his beloved, right? He says mm-hmm. times, "Ooh, I'll have to get the recipe for Mina." Like he's a young man, recently engaged, mm-hmm. and he has this energy of youth and optimism, and this is his first grown up job.
There's gonna be a lot of chicken paprikash on that table. I'll tell you that much.
And not any garlic. I mean,
no garlic. Zero garlic. My people do not eat garlic. That is a thing that comes from the Eastern European nations. I do not eat garlic. When I have pizza, it is a whole evening's worth of pain. I don't do it.
My people is. Did you hear that? Steve calls them my people. Vampires.
Now, after enjoying all of these wonderful, wonderful meals and getting to this very spooky castle, Jonathan starts to realize, like, this isn't good. And so I think the details are so familiar to us, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that Dracula casts no reflection in the mirror. He appears to be the only person in this gigantic castle. He can scale down the walls like a bat. He controls wolves. He has no shadow. I mean, all of these details are super familiar to us. Oh, and he's scared of Jonathan's crucifix, right?
Mm-hmm.
So all of this is pretty familiar. But at the same time, this is an original work. Like, this is an originary work in that it's setting up those tropes that we know so well. And I think that the castle's sort of labyrinthine feel, where Jonathan can't quite map it in his mind. He has access only to a few rooms. His sense of time is really off because Dracula works so much more in the evening and nighttime. And so as Jonathan is like, for how long is he there? Like a month, 2 months? I mean, he's working on this real estate deal, various accounts, et cetera. He's doing his legal work for him. They always meet at night. Now he's sleeping in the day. He becomes very temporally and cognitively unmoored from his life.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those things that make up the mythology of the vampire are all laid out right there by Bram Stoker. And yes, there have been plenty of books that have played with those, but those are pretty universal tropes that, yes, you're right, when we are reading this in the 21st century, we go, oh yeah, we know that. But that's pretty ingenious, the list that he has created here. And creating this genre of the monster and knowing their vulnerabilities here, garlic, mirrors. Dracula is like angry that there is a reflective surface in the house. He shatters it. He throws it out the window. Wow.
And with no servants, I mean, obviously he's going to have to clean it up himself.
Yeah.
But it turns out that Dracula and Jonathan are not alone. And this is one of the really, really interesting parts of this section. And we'll think about it some more, of course. But one night, Jonathan leaves his little area. He sees Dracula scaling down the wall. And he's like, okay, I'm alone in the castle. I'm going to explore a little further. He finds this door that seems to be locked, but it's really just very, very heavy. Pushes through and he goes out. And what does he find but three women? And it's so interesting that these women basically sexually assault our poor Jonathan, and he's seduced / assaulted. It's a very complex scene. But he thinks, I shouldn't write this because Mina will read this journal one day, but I have to write it. This is what happened. Mm-hmm. And he gets into this sexually compromising moment with these women. And then in walks the Count, throws a woman across the room, and is like, he's mine.
Mm-hmm.
So within that moment, this is why we bring up the Oscar Wilde thing, and we'll come back to questions of sexuality. In that scene, which is a very like heart-pounding scene, because what is Dracula going to do? We don't actually fully know what Dracula does, because Jonathan just wakes up later. He doesn't really...
And that's something straight out of Sexual Assault as well,
What are the sexual rules in this gothic Transylvanian castle? Like, Jonathan, everything Jonathan thinks he knows about the world is just turned upside down.
I thought of a few things. One, those three women are kind of the sirens. They basically are luring, you know, where a siren, say, lures a person in the sea, you know, to follow them. They're kind of there. They're tempting him. And then, you know, we have our Dracula, who kind of, the scene where Jonathan's shaving and he cuts himself, he just kind of shows up behind him, just appears. Mm-hmm. And it just seems that there's something going on there, certainly. And there's a tension there, but where that is supposed to go, you know, I guess we can discuss that later on.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan is young, and he's experiencing this different... He's not very superstitious in this.
He's a man of reason.
He's a man of reason.
He's a modern man.
Mm-hmm. But he's kind of chilled by what Dracula has to say here, right?
Well, and I actually have this quotation, and I'll have one of you wonderful Dracula guys read it, because here's the thing. As you read this sort of passage... You can read it as scary, or you can read it as like sort of funny, because it's been made fun of so many times, this kind of scene.
The story of Dracula has been presented in so many different ways, including satirically, as so often for the last 100 years, that we know that it could be played either way. But yes, I think this is a much more frightening advice here. I'll read it for you,
Pam. Go for it.
Let me advise you, my dear young friend. Nay, let me warn you. I did it with a W. Nay, let me warn you with all seriousness that should you leave these rooms, you will not by any chance go to sleep in any part of the castle. It is old and has many memories, and there are bad dreams for those who sleep unwisely. Be warned! Should sleep now or ever overcome you, or be like to do, then haste to your own chamber, or to these rooms, for your rest will then be safe. But if you be not careful in this respect, then... I added that.
Keep reading, though. Keep reading. Keep reading what he does.
He finished his speech in a gruesome way, for he motioned with his hands as if he were washing them. I quite understood. My only doubt was to whether any dream could be more terrible than the unnatural, horrible net of gloom and mystery which seemed closing around me. Whew.
And so this idea of Dracula, like, washing his hands of it, I've warned you, it's up to you. And also this idea of sleep as a time of huge vulnerability. I mean, that's like evolutionarily true. Mm-hmm. Sleep at the time where we're vulnerable, right? That's why it makes sense to move in packs so that someone can always be watching. But Jonathan doesn't have a pack. He's alone here. He has to sleep. And Dracula's telling him, that's when you're vulnerable. And that's-
Don't go into the West Wing. It's forbidden. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that's Beauty
and that's
Beast.
When he sleeps during the day. Right? He sleeps during the day so that he can be watchful at night. So mm-hmm. Once again, like everything Jonathan thinks he knows about the world, a world in which as an educated, you know, young white man with a lovely fiance back at home, he should be on top of the world. All of his power is gone in this moment.
But he's been thrown back to nature, to the wolves. Mm-hmm.
Like, Right. Exactly.
So then we can finally get to the Mina and Lucy conversation here, because yes, we've set up the main story. Dracula is, of course, the main character of this story, and Harker is our introduction to him. But we get then the viewpoint from England, from London, in these letters between Mina and Lucy.
So Steve, you said this was your favorite part. How come?
There's something about the humanity of these two girls who absolutely love each other, who are as close as sisters can be, with being that absolute joy of expressing to each other what's happening in their lives. I miss people, Pam. Zoom is not a great way for me to express my sorrows and my joys. Even though you and I and Chip spend a good amount of time talking about our week, what happened this week before we actually get started with the show. This is a love, a relationship that is really well written here.
There's no hugging over Zoom. Is that what you're saying, Steve?
There's no hugging anywhere, Chip. I can't hug anybody. I don't even know if handshakes are going to be a thing going forward.
Elbow bumps. That's where we're going.
I hate the elbow bumps.
I hate it. Well, and Mina and Lucy really represent two very, very different models of femininity in this late Victorian story, right? So we have Mina, and she says she is not a new woman, so she's not like a young feminist, but she kind of is, you guys.
She kind of is a powerful character in that she recognizes all of these things and reports to us that she's not a powerful character. I'm going to be a fiance. Yeah, it's not working.
But wouldn't that be of its time too? Where you're like, oh, of course I'm not this, but I totally am. I'm totally going to be a new person.
Mm-hmm. Taking up all the skills that she needs to help her fiancé, but she's the one building the skills, which is pretty amazing.
And, you know, we're going to keep an eye on that Mina. She'll get some good things done as we go through this book. She becomes quite a powerful character. And she says to Lucy, I've been working very hard lately because I want to keep up with Jonathan's studies. And I've been practicing shorthand very assiduously. And so she's framing her own accomplishments as like there to support her husband. But you guys, they're going to be there to fight the undead. I mean, her skills are pretty important. Now, Lucy is the pretty one. I'm sure you guys noticed that. Everyone is pretty excited about Lucy. She's very, very charming. And when they meet, like, you know, older guys on the path as they're walking or whatever, everyone's like, ooh, check out that Lucy. And she is a flirt. Now, she tells Mina, and her letter is pretty funny, that she got 3 marriage proposals on the same day. Okay.
Braggart.
And what do you find funny about that? Because I'll tell you what I find funny about it.
Go, Steve.
It's so funny that the next line is, don't tell the girls. Because the girls will think that they will need to get more proposals in a day than I got. They'll be expecting to get 6 in a day. Mm-hmm. That's so funny.
I know. And this, you know, so there's this idea of like these girls, and Lucy tells us she's 19. So we can assume Mina is in that same age range. She feels like she might be 20 or 21. But these young women have a certain amount of power, right? And we also get Lucy's 3 suitors are very, very different from one another.
Mm-hmm.
We have Arthur, who's the wealthy son of Lord Godalming. So, and Godalming, mm-hmm. You know, there's like some wordplay on that name. But so Arthur, the one that she loves, is an aristocrat. So Lucy's about to change classes, my friends, right? Mm-hmm. In our very firmly middle class. Quincy Morris is an American.
Uh-oh.
You know what that means. He's got boots. He's got boots and a hat. That's what it means.
Exactly. By thunder, we know what
and
that
an
means.
And an accent.
And probably guns, right?
Now, my audiobook, I know we're listening to different versions, but the guy had a great American accent. This British reader did a wonderful job with Quincy. And Lucy tells us she loves slang, and she thinks that Quincy's American slang is hilarious.
Yes, I love that.
It's swell.
But it's a very playful moment, right? And it's something, it makes you realize, like, Lucy's really smart. Like, she likes to play with language, and, you know, she's super charming. And then we have Dr. Seward, Dr. John Seward, who's a psychiatrist, and he too, I felt like Lucy worried that she really hurt his feelings by turning down his proposal. Right. With Quincy Morris, the American, he's going to be fine. He's an American cowboy. Right. But with Dr. Seward, she did feel a little bad that she had to turn him down as well in favor of her new aristocratic fiance.
So think about what, I mean, I'm just kind of looking at this and it came to me. We've got a person who's going to go to old status, which is mm-hmm. Arthur. We have Quincy, who basically is the new world, you know, new beginnings, anything can happen, mm-hmm. the American. And then we have the man of science,
yep,
which mm-hmm. is John. And
we also have Jonathan Harker, our white collar businessman.
Yeah.
A lot of different elements of society are represented here.
And done well. All four of these men are well represented. They are strong characters, even though we don't see them in a narrative structure. We are only hearing about them from the perspective of these letters. We understand them pretty well here in the beginning.
And Lucy makes the blood course through their veins.
Along with strangers on the street, apparently. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yep. So we get to the third narrative strand here, which is the Dr. Seward and Renfield, the asylum. Oh, boys, there's some gothic stuff going on in these scenes.
And an asylum is a gothic space, right? Because you're going into madness. So since madness is the opposite of rationality, you're already, there's already a little bit of fear and anxiety as soon as you open the doors of a fictional asylum.
And we've talked about mental health and its treatment in From Hell. We see some of those same modern fears here where, boy, we don't know what happens in these mental health facilities, and what happens seems to be pretty damaging.
Although it's interesting because we see this from Seward's perspective, and he is very much, he believes in the power of science, right? Mm-hmm. Seward is pretty heartbroken by Lucy's rejection, and so he decides he'll just have to throw himself into his work to get over his pain. And he says, why not advance science in its most difficult and vital aspect, the knowledge of the brain? And this is where we are at sort of the beginning of psychology as a serious area of scientific study, trying to understand how the brain works and how pathology works. And so that's our introduction to Renfield, this 59-year-old patient who Seward looks at with great interest. What did you think of Renfield, Steve?
Well, I know of Renfield from all of my explorations of Dracula up until this point. I know that he is not exactly the Igor character in this story. He's a different sort of piece of the puzzle of the mystery that is Dracula. But the main theme that I got from him is this idea of how important life is, and he's collecting life and consuming life, and that line between life and death is really well presented here.
The scene where the flies to the spiders, the spiders to the birds, and the birds, hey, I need some cats.
But he doesn't get a cat, so he decides to consume the birds instead.
He has an account book, right? So he's keeping track of how many flies were eaten by how many spiders, were eaten by how many birds, And then those are all the lives that he is taking in. Mm-hmm. So there's this sort of like pathological accounting procedure.
There's a methodical science to it there.
Well, and there's a sort of like rewriting of accounting, right? Of this very respectable white collar middle class profession in this very dark, manic way.
Later on, as you know, we get more Dracula stuff, you know, this may come into play because, you know, what we have a human being consumed by a vampire.
It right? is thematic. I agree with you.
Yes. So guys, as we sort of close out this episode, I want to just raise for us as we move forward some of the big Victorian issues that we've been talking about all through the pandemic, things that are very much still alive and with us today. So themes that I just want to point out are the question of globalization, the idea that Jonathan can travel to Transylvania, it's a much smaller world than it used to be, and the anxiety about immigration, about the fact that Dracula is planning to come to London. What does that mean with all of Dracula's unusual features? There's the theme of epistemological uncertainty. How do we know what we know? Which is more accurate to understanding the world, science or religion, or maybe even some sort of Eastern superstition? Then we have questions of gender. So what are the different models of masculinity and femininity that we see here? With Mina versus Lucy, as two young women who have two very different approaches that are marked by class, because Mina is very much staying in the middle class, whereas Lucy is climbing to the aristocracy. Then we have at least four models of masculinity, well, maybe five or six, but we have Harker's middle-class masculinity, Seward, the man of science, Quincy, the American cowboy, Godalming, the aristocrat. Dracula will have to think about what kind of masculinity he represents. And then we have questions of sexuality. So what does it mean that Jonathan is the first victim of sexual assault in this slash seduction? What does it mean that he is approached by women, but then he's basically, he's the witness to Dracula saying, this one's mine. So what does that mean? And then we have various changing technologies. We only have a hint about that in this first section. We've got Jonathan Seward's phonograph, but we're going to get a lot more about how technology is changing the world in 1897. So keep it up. There's a million themes to be looking at, and there are themes we've been talking about for the past however many days. I don't even know anymore.
Who knows? I lost track last Blursday.
Well, certainly we're going from our ideas of the past or what we think of the past to sort of the maybe a modern redefinition of these in many ways. And so nothing could be more modern than the 1890s, I guess.
That's what we're finding out. Chip and I, we did not know that. This has been your study, Pam. You've known this for a long time, that this is such a turning point between the old ideas and the modern ideas. Chip and I are finding this out. And yes, we keep seeing in every one of these pieces all of this change and all of this modernization.
I can't wait to grow up, Steve.
I can't wait to read a book that's not from the Victorian era.
We'll get there, Steve. We'll get there.
One day, Steve. Time marches on.
But next week is not that time. So, Pam, what is our assignment for next week on Sandwiches at Irregular Hours?
Well, keep reading Dracula, my friends, chapters 7 to 13. And some really interesting things are going to happen. Trust me.
Oh, that's my favorite moment of this whole show. Thank you, Chip. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week.
What do you think, Pam? Are we all right for a week?
We're good.
All right. I look forward to continuing this story. Again, this is one of those stories that most of us know without having read. I hope everybody out there is reading along with us for the first time for many of you. And keep sending us your feedback. We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Our website is sandwiches@irregularhours.com. Send us an email, sandwiches@irregularhours@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. Keep on listening. Keep on reading. We'll see you back here next week. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hasenplug, dressed as Robert Smith from The Cure.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
I don't say blah, blah, blah.